Welcome to the Mud Island Adventures podcast. I'm your host, Garrick McMullen, and I'm here to help you find your adventure right here in the UK. Hello, and welcome back to the Mud Island Adventures podcast. I'm here, Garrick McMullen, your host as always, and with me is Lee. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you today, my friend?
I'm chipper. I'm absolutely chipper. I've got over my bad knee. Great news. Great news. It turns out it was a bit of gout, which means that...
we're getting old. Yes, we know that.
Yeah, we're getting old. too much red wine, maybe. I don't know. But okay, so that's good news. That means I'm not out of action completely for
excellent
a long time. However, bit of bad news, people, with the challenge, the triple challenge that is was due to go ahead in September. I'm really sorry to let you all down at this stage, but with another injury that I sustained whilst on the King Alfred's Way coming up for a couple of months ago, I've not been able to ride. And with the knee injury recently, a couple of other bits and pieces, plus Alex is going to be at the other end of the country. In fact, he's going to be in a different country, and he's going to be up in Scotland that weekend with work commitment that he can't get out of. So we've decided that at this stage, it's probably better just to put things on hold a little bit and postpone the triple challenge till probably sometime in early-ish 22, so spring 22, when we can do it. Fear not, however, dear listener, I reckon the thing to do here is set myself a little challenge anyway, just to keep me ticking over, because as you're all aware by now, I like to push myself a little bit, and I do like a little challenge, and I love just seeing what I can get into. So join me if you will, but the same weekend, so still the weekend of the 11th, 12th, 13th of September. Here's what I'm going to do. I am going to start, I think, at Devizes on the Kennet and Avon Canal, and I'm going to make my way along the Kennet and Avon Canal in an easterly direction and see how far I can get in 24 hours. Just why not? I may be supported, I may not be supported. We haven't quite ironed out the details yet, but that's the idea. So, update to the triple challenge. We're going to postpone that to 2022. I'm going to go get myself on the water with the paddleboard for 24 hours in September anyway, because that's the kind of guy I am.
Just look out for the geese, mate. They get a bit gnarly, don't they, with just before migration. So
they'll be trying to stock up and on
food
as well, which, I think at the moment with the lack of training going on, they'll fit into that category. But there we go. somebody who is not hanging about, I'll tell you that, or hasn't been. We just want to say a really big congratulations to Martin Longmuir on Instagram's 2020 turning 40. Amazing effort on behalf of Friends of Anchor, which is a cancer research and care charity up there in Scotland. He has run, and we've talked about this before, but he has run. He's done it. He completed it. Mountain marathons, completed it. 10 of them in 10 days. Okay. Now, just to put that into figures, 420 kilometres, give or take 100 metres or so, 262 miles in 10 days, with a climbing equivalent to almost two times the height of Everest.
Whoa.
I sat earlier on Strava. Oh, my goodness. So let's put this into perspective. There's 14 mountains in the world that are over 8,000 metres in height. With Everest being the highest at 8,848 metres. I'm sure everybody knows that. However, Martin covered around about 16,000 meters of vertical ascent.
Jeez. 10 days. Wow. That,
which I think is, it really was a mountain marathon. So huge congratulations, Martin. If you haven't done already, head over to his Instagram page, check out 2020 turning 40. There's a link in his bio to the Friends of Anchor where you can donate. Please do so. A worthy cause and such an amazing effort. So well done, Martin. And to add to that, I'm going to be interviewing Martin hopefully in the next week or so. So there'll be an extra podcast coming out in between this and our next one. So there we go. We're still on Instagram, Mud Island Adventures, and Facebook. You can join the group. You can see more details about Martin's incredible effort on the Facebook group. He's been posting some, or he posted it every day and shared some content with us. So check that out. There's also quite a lot going on there. I know it's the school holidays now. The ones are running around, bless their little cotton socks. UK, we're now in the thick of it. I know, Scotland, you've been doing that for a little while now, haven't you, Lee?
Yep. We have. Yeah, kids everywhere. It's great.
Love it. If you're beginning to tear your hair out, looking for ideas, there's some really good ideas coming through on the Facebook group. So get on there, join up, and let's share some knowledge, dudes and dudettes. Okay. Lee, I want to ask you a question.
Yes.
Now, as a former pilot, as a private pilot, enjoyed the sensation of breaking Earth's bonds.
Indeed.
You know, of coming free from gravity.
Yes.
And that's what we're going to talk about today, is doing that, but without the engine, without all the fuff and kerfuffle. I want to talk about paragliding. Now, for those of you who aren't aware, paragliding, not to be confused with hang gliding. Hang gliding tends to be with a more rigid delta-shaped wing where you hang underneath it in a sort of a prone position underneath. Paragliding is a soft wing which fills with air before takeoff, hopefully. I'm kidding, it does. You make sure it happens. Essentially, it creates an aerofoil like a big parachute, if you imagine a big parachute shape of a wing, which you are able to fly from either a position of elevation or by being towed into the air. Now, essentially, you sit under this parachute in a slightly more comfortable version of parachute harness, where you're sat back and you can put your feet up a little bit and fly around. And there's two main ways to paraglide. One of those is, like I say, from a high point using updrafts of air wind or moving air hitting the high feature pushes up, and you're able to surf a wave of air, which is really quite tasty, I tell you. So hours and hours of fun to be had just soaring up and down hillsides. And if any of you are aware, I'm sure you've done some talk about thermal activity, haven't you, Lee, in the past with flying? But essentially, cross-country paragliding pilots rely on thermal updraft for movement from point to point, or in a triangle, or an out and back. But we'll talk about that a bit more later.
The thermals and stuff that you talk about, I mean, because with light powered flight, you're obviously traveling a lot higher, you're traveling a lot faster. So, I mean, yes, you are subject to the thermals when it comes to light aviation, but it's certainly not as reliant upon them as paragliding is. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty essential stuff to understand where that comes from and how it's created and how to make the most of it.
So the beauty of paragliding is that all of this kit packs down into a bag that you can put on your back, and you're not reliant on lots of logistics to get these things around. You don't have to go to an airfield, although you will have to go to a recognised site in the UK, certainly, certainly in England and Wales. So I know what you're thinking. How do I get started? Now, there are clubs all over the place. all over the UK. And the best place to start your search is through the British Hang Gliding and Paragliding Association. And they have a list of registered schools. Now, the BHPA are the governing body for the sport. And it is, you know, it's an incredible sport. Although it does have some sort of safety aspects, as you as you'd expect with any sort of aviation type sport, there are quite a few safety things that you need to bear in mind. So right here, right now, I'm going to urge everyone not to just go onto eBay or watch a bit of YouTube and think, aha, yeah, I've got this nailed. I can take my unserviced wing to the nearest hill, lob myself off, and I'm going to be absolutely fine. That's not the case. You do need to go in and get some training. I can't emphasize enough how important that is. So find yourself a school, a BHPA registered school, and start your journey with them. And the beauty of that is that an instructor, once you've registered for a course, if you go with an instructor, they can take you on a tandem flight, or most instructors will be able to take you on a tandem flight. So essentially, they'll be able to take away the initial self-reliant risk that you'd expect from this sort of sport. And you can experience firsthand breaking gravity's bonds using this incredible sort of naturally powered flight method. And it's wonderful. Now, from there, you can your first step as a paraglider pilot is to complete your club pilot course. So you'll do an elementary pilot course where you learn the basics of takeoff, landing, meteorology, where you can, can't, rules, can't, you know, mustn't, don'ts, and all the rest of it. And you'll experience your first hops, so your first short flights, usually from a lower hill in a suitable environment. And that's sort of heavily monitored and supervised by your instructors. Once you've completed the requirements for elementary pilot, you'll go on to club pilot. So there's a little more to do with that. So there's some air lore involved, more meteorology, because as you go through the sport, you'll understand in order to harness nature, you need to understand its weather patterns as best you can. And I must admit, it was one of the aspects that I found really, really useful and really quite interesting. I know my wife listens to this, she'll be like, ah, yes, geek.
But it is fascinating. It really is. And whether that, you know, whether we're talking about the creation of thermal energy through the movement of wind, and or whether we're talking about the tides in any kind of water sport, it is really interesting where this stuff comes from and how it can affect performance, how it can affect even just the doability of any particular activity on any particular day. So, yeah. I mean, it's a really important aspect to understand and to, you know, get a hold of so that you can plan your activities around what the weather's doing, which we get a lot of. As we've said before, you know, we do get a lot of weather here. So knowing what it's going to do and knowing, being prepared for it is pretty much key to any sort of activity here in the UK.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's, you know, understanding all these aspects will help keep you safe in the air and on the ground, because you know, sometimes launching a paraglider is the more dangerous of the aspects, to be fair. The best thing to do, go and find yourself a local school, and I'm you're probably looking at somewhere in the region of about £500 to £1,000, depending on where you go and kit hire and all the rest of it, to get started in the sport. And that's to, you know, sort of get you off the ground and get you sort of club pilot standard. And once you hit club pilot, it means that you can join a local club. You have to join the BHPA. They can, they have the third party insurance, and as a governing body, they sort of overarch everything and take care in, you know, do the safety assurance for all the clubs, etc. But you can join a local club, BHP registered, BHPA registered rather, And they will have a list of flying sites that you can go to. Now, it's, when you think of, well, when a lot of people think of paragliding, they think of the sort of the roots of the sport, which were formed in the high Alps. And essentially, mountaineers decided that it was too dangerous to climb back down after they'd climbed to the top of the, you know, of big mountains. And they realized that actually flying from the top would probably be safer. So they started out in sport parachutes, actually, back in the 70s, like, you know, wow. And ended up throwing themselves, launching from these hills, from the mountains, and flying back down rather than climbing, because, believe it or not, that's where the majority of accidents happen, is on the climb down. Who knew?
You're saying flying. I'm hearing controlled fall, but okay.
Well, you know, right. Technically it is a controlled fall. You just understand that so long as you can beat gravity by staying in an airflow moving up, and you're moving up with it faster than gravity is trying to pull you down. That's the aspect. But anyway, yeah. So the upshot of that is that, you know, a lot of the time you think about big mountains, and that's not at all true. You know, the highest elevation that we have in Wiltshire is absolutely nothing compared to some of the lower the foothills in the Highlands and in parts of Wales. So, but we're still able to fly, and you can fly pretty much anywhere in the UK. There's, you know, anywhere that airspace allows it. And there is a feature to fly from. So you can fly on the coast. Coastal flying is beautiful. You're flying in really nice, smooth air most of the time. Or you can go up to the Highlands and do a bit of hiking and flying around the Highlands. And that's become really popular over the last few years in terms of people. Because you can put it on your back. Kit's getting lighter as it becomes more advanced, more technologically advanced. And you can actually, put this kit on your back. It doesn't. I think my first set of kit probably weighed about 20 something kilos. The kit I finished off with, which was my lightweight kit, probably weighed somewhere around 9. So the kit now is getting much, much better and much, much lighter.
That is quite a difference. That really is.
Yeah. So I started getting into a thing called hike and fly racing. So essentially you started off, the one I did was the Dragon Hike and Fly, and that was run by a guy called Alistair Andrews, who runs Crick Howell Paragliding in South Wales. So check him out, crickhowellparagliding.com. If you're in that area for a bit of Welsh tuition, he's extremely good. But he organises the Dragon Hike and Fly race, which is a set course around the Brecon Beacons and Black Mountains. And essentially, you've got to get from the start to a couple of checkpoints dotted around the place to the finish line. You've got a couple of days to do it, and you can either stay out in the mountains overnight or get recovered back to a point at the end of the first day, and then shuttle back out in the morning. But if you aren't flying, and flying is the obvious way to do that, but if you're not flying, you're walking. So, an 80-kilometre course can be quite painful, because that's 80 kilometres as the crow flies, not as the Garrick walks. So, yeah. But, things like that, if that's your bag. But essentially, paragliding... in terms of equipment, you can spend quite a lot of money on equipment, with wings anywhere between sort of 2,500 to 5,000 pounds for the more advanced stuff, brand new. And then you've got harness, which again is another 1,000 pounds, and then you're looking at probably at least another 500 for a reserve parachute, helmet, flying gear. It does add up. And admittedly, paragliding is not the cheapest sport. But you can do it cheaper. What I would recommend, though, is, wait until you've done a bit of training. Get a feel for it first. Don't go splurging out on it. And it's really good fun.
It sounds to me like it's a very visceral experience. I mean, to me, having sort of come from light aviation, light aircraft, that would be more like driving a car. What you're describing to me sounds more like the difference between that and riding a motorcycle. You know, you've got that sort of, you know, you're, I mean, you are literally, quite literally, flying by the seat of your pants. You're in that harness. Okay. You're looking, you know, you're referencing from the ground and from all these other features, and you're feeling through the contact with the risers, you know, up to the wing and everything, you know, what the air around you is doing. So it must be a very, raw, very natural sort of way to get off the ground. That's what it's certainly sounding like to me.
It is. I mean, it is a very involving sport. And I've got to say that one of the beautiful things about flying a paraglider is that when you're doing it, you really can't think about anything else.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you know, if you want a bit of headspace, that's the place to do it. You know, it's one of the things I found that you were absolutely involved in what you were doing. There was no concerning yourself with, I've got to complete this spreadsheet and get it into the boss, or I've got to, you know, the car's due an MOT next month. All of that goes away for the time that you are flying, because it's just, you know, and it's a really friendly sport as well. You know, I've only met one or two paraglider pilots that I didn't like, and well, you know, that was just, that was just because of other things, not because necessarily because they were paraglider pilots.
How long from first starting to getting out there on your own with your own kit, what sort of time frame are you looking at?
So a lot of that's weather dependent. You know, like you say, we do get a lot of weather in this on this island, and it's not always favourable for paragliding, particularly when you're starting out, because you need slighter winds, you need just, you know, the right conditions. if you have the ability, I would genuinely recommend training abroad, which I know sounds counterintuitive to what you know, to what we preach about Mud Island, but just in terms of learning, being you know, in Spain or Portugal, you know, somewhere nice and warm where the weather is more consistent.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's not a new thing either. You know, you know, certainly during the Second World War, I'm throwing history out there again, as you know I would. But a lot of the RAF pilots, or the Royal Naval Air Service pilots, that, you know, they trained in the US, they trained in Canada, they trained in Rhodesia, South Africa, and places like that. So why? Because the consistently good weather, so they can consistently fly, they can build those skills, and they can, you know, do all of that. And what Garrick's saying is exactly right. You know, if you're going to go and, you know, fly here in the UK, then most of what, whether that's paragliding or general aviation, light aircraft, you're mostly going to do it in the good weather anyway. You know, but training that environment as well, and it makes it so much more pleasurable.
It does, so much more
challenging when you come back as well, because then you've got another element to consider.
Yeah, and the beauty of it is you never stop learning, I don't think. You know, it's one of these.
No, you never do.
It's kind of like golf for men, but in that, you'll never quite get it right every time. So, you know, it's, there's definitely challenges to be had from it. And beautiful times.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it is. Wonderful. So, if that's not your idea, and you want to, you know, your idea of fun, and maybe keeping your feet or tires on the ground are a little more down your street, then the big adventure this week, mate, is it's a pretty big one. So. As you all know, I'm a keen cyclist, and you know, having recently done the King Alfred's Way, which you know, was pretty tough, 350 k's over just over 48 hours. You know, I found it pretty tough, and I'm still suffering for it, to be fair. But these guys are absolutely mental. And it's this is just one of several races. So the another race that I'm going to talk about in the future links in quite nicely to this. Now, the Great British Divide is a self-supported bike race, or an ultra-distance bike race, essentially. So let me get this right. 2,000 kilometres. Yes, that's right. 2,000 kilometres, self-supported, ultra-distance bike packing. It's 65% off-road. And they recommend, well, you need a mountain bike, basically. So that kicked off on the 31st of July this month. 31st of July this month? Okay, kicked off this on the year. 31st. I've got to stop. Maybe I should start drinking. I'm not drinking.
I think you should, yeah.
I need to get back to it. So it started on the 31st of July and is due to close. So the last sort of cutoff for it will be on Saturday, the 14th of August at 6 p.m. So, but the idea is, now they start off in Canterbury and end up in a place called Applecross on the west coast of the Scottish Highlands, and do a big L shape. So they go from Canterbury, sort of track down towards, over towards the New Forest, and then up across the Welsh borders, and then basically up the west coast of England, and then into Scotland to finish off at Applecross. 2,000 kilometres. I mean, it's absolutely barking. Mm. Absolutely mental. Now, if you want to know more about the Great British Divide, or you're interested in ultra-distance bike packing or adventure rides, or maybe, you know, you just want to find out a bit more about it or how to follow it, if you go to where is it? GreatBritishDivide.com. You can also link into Dot Watcher. So that's dot watcher.cc and check out the race in real time. Maybe not quite as exciting to watch as the Olympics, in which we've done really bloody well, by the way. But, you know, still pretty cool watching, because it's all done by satellite trackers. Yeah. And you can watch people's sort of graduation, migration across and up the country into Scotland. And you know what? Hats off to them. And if it's too late and you've missed this one, I'll know. The GB Giro is coming up in a couple of weeks' time. I think just as this finishes, the GB Giro starts. Now, the GB Giro is a similar type of thing where racers will race from Land's End to John O'Groats. Mostly off-road.
Yeah, because it's not tough enough, is it? You know, let's add another element.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it is a self-supported bike packing race, which goes the length of the country and and Scotland. So, you know, there's sort of three main stages to that, and you basically travel up the country. And again, Dot Watcher. .cc is the place to go if you want to follow that along. A good mate of mine, Adam Colvin, is going to be taking part in that this year. He unfortunately crashed out of the race in 2019, so this is his comeback tour, and he'll be hoping to complete the race or the challenge in a good time. So yeah, if you want to see some people doing that, check out dotwatcher.cc. There's loads of races on there where you can do it. Theracingcollective.com for GB Duro and greatbritishdivide.com. So there you go. Actually, you got two big adventures in one this week.
Yeah.
Lucky people. But yeah, we wish all those athletes all the best of luck.
Absolutely. I mean, it's an incredible feat. really.
Well, I don't know if it's so much about the feet. It's
about quads, the legs quad. And the rest of the, yeah. And the knees, the hips, the back.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay.
Excellent. So, and after that,
yes.
You'll probably need a rest. When you're not dot watching, what are we going to do instead? What's the armchair adventure?
So, the armchair adventure, we brought you some, we tried to be sort of, you know, diverse about what we were bringing in the armchair adventure. You know, we brought you some classic literature with Swallows and Amazons. Yeah. We brought, you know, reminded you about the beautiful movie that is The Endless Summer. We've talked about, you know, Ross Edgeley's book about his mammoth swim around the UK. So we try to look at different things. And in this week's armchair adventure, it's not a long one. It's a Netflix original documentary from 2017 by Josh Eisenberg and Wynne Padula. And at 27 minutes, it's not long, but it is a very powerful documentary. It's called Resurface, and it follows a mostly American but some British veterans and how they are dealing with the trauma of traumatic brain injuries, multiple amputations, and post-traumatic stress given their service over in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they're dealing with this through surfing. And the main story follows a former US Marine called Bobby Lane, who was injured in Iraq, suffered from a traumatic brain injury. And his his plan one day was that he was going to go surfing. He was going to tick that box. And then, having had enough of everything, he was going to go home, take out his gun, and take his own life. But he went surfing, he ticked that box, and the next day he went surfing again. And now he is a mentor with Operation Surf out of Santa Cruz in California to other wounded veterans. Now, Operation Surf was set up by a man, and I hope I'm getting this pronunciation correct, Van Kruatsa, who is a former surf competitor. He's been surfing about 45 years. And he's also a former addict by his own admission. He has had his own demons. So he can relate somewhat to the experiences that these men and women have been through. And one of the things that he says to Bobby Lane at the beginning of the documentary is just get out of your head. That's the worst place that you can be. So over the next 27 minutes or so, we get introduced to neuroscientists and we get introduced to psychologists. We, you know, we talk to some of the veterans and to Van Kruatsa, and how we've mentioned before, Garrick and I, about how surfing is mindfulness and motion. We're talking just now about how paragliding is, you know, you're involved in that activity to nothing else is coming through your head. And so the neuroscience and the psychology backs this up. And these men and women they're healing as best they can and as well as they can by getting out into the water. Because this immersion in nature, it heals us. It's where we're from. So when we can reconnect with it, then it is very, very powerful healing that goes on at a very deep level. I'm not going to pretend to understand the neuroscience or the biology or everything that, but there is just something very real, very true about getting out into these natural environments. And as Van says at the end of the documentary, says, thinking about the waves tomorrow, they're not going to kill themselves today. So these organizations exist, mental health and that reconnection with nature, whether that's through surfing, whether that's through walking in the mountains or any other activity, it's very real. That healing process of being out in nature, away from the screens, away from the traffic, away from the busyness of urban life is extremely therapeutic. And that's what Resurface is really about. It's about human beings reconnecting with nature, having been through the kind of horrors that most of us can never even begin to imagine. So Resurface is this week's armchair adventure. It's still available on Netflix. I rewatched it this morning just to remind myself. And it's not an easy watch. It's not a fun-filled half hour, but it is definitely an important message, either for ourselves or for perhaps a friend, co-worker or family member, if they are suffering in some way, and you can encourage them to get out there into nature. The effect is remarkable. It really is. So Resurface on Netflix is this week's armchair adventure.
Beautiful. And yeah, I mean, I watched it and yeah, it's pretty close to my heart and Lee's, and the whole mental health aspect of being out in nature and having adventures is something that we are looking to cover in our next episode, which will be episode 10, amazingly.
Double figures.
Now, that won't include the interview that I do with Martin. So what we're hoping to do is I've got a load of people that I want to talk to. And I think Lee probably has some people he wants to talk to. So what we're going to try and do over coming weeks, months, maybe years, is intersperse the main sort of podcast with some interviews with people that we found to be either inspirational or, you know, have done amazing things, and, you know, or people we just want to have a chat with because we think they're really, really interesting. So, yeah, that's soon to come, but certainly episode 10. Will be about how we perceive adventure and being in nature to help mental health.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, it's not just that, you know, it's pretty deep.
Yeah, it is.
Makes me just want to lie down in the dark.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And if you're going to do that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the year, it's the time of year, really, for sort of, if you're going to go and lay down in the dark, well, you might as well do that outside. We've talked about sleeping out. We've talked about getting sunrises and sunsets on photograph. But there's something quite remarkable in the middle of all of that, and that is the night sky itself. Mm-hmm. So this week's weekend win is about stargazing. For millennia, people have looked up to the stars and they've seen these patterns up there, and they called them Cygnus, the swan, they've called them Orion, the hunter. And those patterns are still there today that we can still see. And it's a way of connecting with our past. It's also a way of connecting with the past of the universe. Because when you think about it, when we're looking out at those stars, the light that is coming from them is millions of years old. So it's remarkable, really. But it doesn't have to be massively complex. It doesn't have to be hugely expensive. You don't need a telescope the size of a car, although that does help. But you can just go out on a clear night with the naked eye, with a set of binoculars, even with a decent, you know, camera. And maybe if you have a telescope, then even better. But you can still go out and look at these stars, find these patterns in the sky that our ancestors discovered, and even some of the planets as well. So to do that, obviously, we need to be, it's weather dependent, we need a clear night. But also we need to be away from light pollution. So we need to be away from that urban environment as much as possible. So the timing of it can be to do with the seasons and also with the moon. Because on a bright full moon, yes, that's great if you want to look at that, but the stars that surround it will be obscured by the brightness from the moon. So depending on what you want to look at, you might want to sort of consider the weather and the light pollution and the moon phase as well before you get out there. But you can pick out these constellations and some of the planets. And if you need a little hand with that, because there are a lot of them, then you can use various sort of books, but also there's quite a few apps. Star Tracker, Star Chart, Skyview, there's just three of many, many apps that are available for you to pursue this. Stargazing, it's something you can do as a family, it's something you can do on your own, it's something that you can do out in the country, away from everywhere. Or, you know, you can go to, there's lots of observatories around the country which will enable you to get up close and personal with the telescopes and have very enthusiastic and very knowledgeable staff that you can quiz. And of course, there are clubs around as well that you can get involved with. But really, you just need a little bit of clear sky and get out there and go check out some of these amazing patterns in the sky. And maybe you may even see the Milky Way itself. So, weekend win, stargazing.
Love it. I've got to say that my favourite depiction of the moon, or the portrayal of the moon, was by Noel Fielding.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and if you haven't seen The Mighty Boosh, check it out.
I think I was living somewhere foreign when all that stuff went off. I kind of missed that. Didn't quite.
That's all right. Cool, mate.
Cool.
Brilliant. Yeah, I think the other aspect to add to the whole stargazing thing is that as navigators, stars can be a really, really useful tool, as they have been for navigators throughout the centuries. So, yeah, check them out. Check out some stars. We like the stars.
We do. I was waiting for you to drop a dad joke in there at some point about planets, but anyway, we'll move on quickly. No?
So it sounds like you've got one. Go for it, go on.
No.
Okay,
fine. No, you know, if you want to. No, go on. We'll move on. If it's not obvious, then that's all good.
Built us up and let us down there, mate. I'm sorry.
Story of my life.
Okay, I'll have to think of one now. Okay. Well, while I'm doing that, you guys can crack on with the rest of your day, I think. But thank you again for joining us on another Mud Island Adventures podcast. It's been a blast doing all the research and finding out and going out and having fun and doing stuff so that we can, you know, talk about it on here. And yeah, we look forward to our next episodes coming up. So tune in for that. And if you're not already a member of the group, like I said, get on Facebook, hit us up on Mud Island Adventures. And check us out on the Instagram, Twitter, and all that other good stuff. I promise, at some point, guys and girls, there will be a website, but it's a little way off yet. Sorry about that. But we're getting there.
It's a work in progress.
One day.
Yes.
But that's about it, I think, Lee, for this week. So what else is there to do?
Well, like I say, we enjoy researching this stuff so we can tell you about it. And now it's your turn. So go, do, and then tell us about it.